This October, a nonprofit, volunteer-run retailer providing a variety of handmade products supporting marginalized artisans and farmers across the globe. Details at crossroadshandcrafts.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Music didn't always sound the same as it does today. The way musicians tuned the notes were different, and they're getting that way again.
There's a song I'd recommend by They Might Be Giants called Dog, which is in 31 tone equal temperament. It's really brilliant the way they do it.
Author Kyle Gann tells us about the arithmetic of music. Plus, Ryan Denham talks cannabis and other issues with Bloomington City Council member Julie Emick, and we dive into a new policy treatise on funding municipal government, the people's money.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Music didn't always sound the way it does today. In fact, a couple of hundred years ago, what we now think of as classical music was then popular music, and it was tuned differently. It's trending toward tuning diversity again. Kyle Gann is the author of The Arithmetic of Listening, Tuning Theory and History for the Impractical Musician. That's just out from the University of Illinois Press. Gann says we didn't always have 12 tones to an octave.
The easier way to put it is we've got as many tones in an octave as we want. How they eventually settled into 12 is kind of a mathematical compromise. If you take the mathematically simplest interval, which is da-da, and then you go da-da, and you go around, you do that 12 times, you get sort of around to the same pitch, but not quite.
What other schemes or arrangements for dividing the tones would have been common even in Beethoven's day?
During the 17th and 18th centuries, there was a lot of argument about tuning, and people were coming up with different ways of doing it. And in the 17th century, there were even people arguing for more than 12 pitches to the octave, and some people, including George Frederick Handel, had a keyboard with split keys on it, so he actually had 14 pitches to the octave. It was all about getting the most consonant chords purely in tune. Most consonant chords being, of course, the major and minor triads we're familiar with, but if you get those perfectly in tune, then each chord will work in some keys but not in others. So you can get all your chords in tune for one key, but then if you play in another key, they're not in tune anymore. So much easier to explain pure tuning than it is to explain the tuning we actually use.
Well, it's an approximation, and it's a matter of taste in some cases, right?
Yeah.
Not just mathematics.
No, but you know, I keep my piano at home and my piano at school tuned to a late 18th century tuning, which is just better in every respect. I lose nothing. I can play anything in that tuning. Each key is a little bit different from the other ones, and you can get more variety of color. C major sounds pure, F sharp major sounds very austere. You just get a lot more variety.
So why did we settle on this? I mean, usually in any big knockdown, drag-out debate, there are blood and guts on the floor. Whose were they?
Well, this was settling into equal temperament, the tuning we use now, was a slow process that kind of took place without many people noticing. It was theorists quit arguing about tuning after the 18th century, and after that, it was pretty much up to the piano tuners. And actually, the part of the thing is the piano wasn't the dominant instrument in European music until around the 1780s. And so when string instruments were the dominant instrument. The strings could play any notes in tune that they wanted. When people were playing harpsichords were very simple to retune and could be done very quickly. It was the dominance of the piano that made everything kind of settle into one-size-fits-all compromise, because pianos are very difficult to retune.
Another story of technology ruins everything, then. You had alluded to it in how you tune your piano, but how much different do Bach and Haydn sound in the tunings in which they chose to write the music?
Well, certainly not unrecognizable or anything. You're much more aware of it if you're playing the music than if you're just listening to it. But in some keys, there's hardly any difference at all. But for instance, I love to play the slow movement of Beethoven's Appassionata Sonata because it's in the key of D flat. And D flat is a really strange key in that tuning. It's got a real buzz to it, and that's a slow movement, very languid, but you play it in its correct tuning, and it has a kind of energy to it that keeps it going. When if I take it down a half step to the key of C, I want to play it faster because it no longer has the energy to sustain the chords. You might not notice the difference in any one performance, but you take a piece and start moving around different keys, and the differences are pretty amazing.
It sounds then like this tendency would affect how people composed music after the piano became dominant.
Absolutely. Composers always gravitate toward what sounds good in the tuning they've got.
Give us a couple examples of how that manifested.
First of all, in the medieval era, the major third, da-da, was considered a dissonant interval because they tuned it differently. And the way they tuned it was very difficult to sing in tune. And when the English music kind of invaded France along with Henry V, the English were singing their major thirds more simply in tune, and so composers started using them. The whole style of music changed during the 15th century because all of a sudden their major thirds were in tune.
That's from a 15th century English music work, Alleluia, a New Work.
More recently, I mean, one of the pieces I write about at length is Lamont Young's well-tuned piano, in which he completely retunes the instrument along flat minor sevenths, which are more in tune, and leaving out the usual thirds altogether. And so you hear, it's a whole different world, and some of the pitches are very close together. And so there's kind of a shimmering sound as he runs through these pitches that are separated only by just a fraction of a half step.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Kyle Gann, the author of the new book, The Arithmetic of Listening. So if the winners not only write the history, they write the music. What did the piano do to choral music, which has a rich tradition, much like strings do, but is not limited to specific pitches?
Right. Well, choral directors in general, are pretty aware of what they should avoid with the piano. I have talked to choral directors who will tell the chorus when they're singing, like especially a long major triad at the end of a piece, to lower the major third to get it more in tune. And you have to be careful not to follow the piano too closely. Pablo Casals used to tell his students, don't be afraid to be out of tune with the piano. It's out of tune. You're not. One of the interesting things that has come out of my being so involved in this subject is I frequently hear from people who sing barbershop quartet, because the barbershop quartet people can't use the piano to rehearse. It doesn't have the pitches they use. Inflected singing that goes into harmonics that we don't use in classical music, and they rehearse in small enclosed spaces so they can get themselves perfectly in tune.
They're not singing "Every Good Boy Deserves Fudge." What are they singing?
No, they're singing, if you go up the harmonic series, which would be easier with a demonstration, they're singing the dominant seventh chord, da 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 da, with a flatter seventh than you can find on the piano, because it's more in tune that way. And going from chord to chord, their progressions are much more convincing if they can shift microtonally depending on what the root of the chord is. And so you look at I did a keyboard transcription of a barbershop quartet song, and I had to have about 30 pitches to the octave to get them all in. So you can, if you have enough pitches on your keyboard, you can play perfectly in tune with barbershop quartet, but you can't do it with just 12.
Are barbershop quartets a sign of the future as we become less limited by technology than the piano?
Well, I don't know. Barbershop quartet is such a vernacular and kind of rural tradition. It would be lovely to think that. The classical music world is not interested in microtonality, but the people who are the people who make electronic music software. And I think the innovation is going to come from those people, because there are enough of them interested, and they know there are people who, you know, electronic software is all math. There's no reason to not put as many pitches in as you want. It's very, very simple. And so there are some really good programs. Now, I might mention one called Custom Scale Editor, which is a fantastically accessible program for coming up with any kind of tuning you want.
When will use of those percolate into popular music rather than the sphere of the pure composer?
Well, I don't keep up with a lot of pop music, but I think it's happening faster in pop music than it is in classical music. And in particular, there's a song I'd recommend by They Might Be Giants called Dog, which is in 31 tone equal temperament.
He's the kind of dog who, when presented with his heart's desire, will turn his nose away. The kind of dog who sees a smiling friend and says, I need no smiling friend today. He's a dog that made his money selling troubled assets. Now he spends his time staring at the door. Staring at the door.
Really brilliant the way they do it, and they have the breaks between verses are done by a harmonica, and I hoped it was a microtonal harmonica, but I'm told they just did electronic pitch bends on it.
She's the kind of dog who
Let me back up in the discussion a little bit. Even the construction of the piano has changed over decades, and the materials that are used now to build pianos are different than they were a century ago. Has that shifted the idea of tuning at all?
No, it really hasn't. There are some pianos out there. People have made some experimental keyboards. I saw a video of one in England, I think, that would allow you to move the peg that the string was released to. You can't have a really steel strings like a piano and do this. But people are trying out different instrument designs, and there are a lot of microtonal keyboards that they kind of look like honeycombs. They've got the keyboard will look like a honeycomb. It'd be all six-sided keys, and people are working with that and learning to play them. The sounds end up being electronic, but you can get excellent piano sounds. I use a piano simulator software called Pianotech, and some people can't tell it from a piano. I have fooled piano tuners into thinking it's a real piano.
So while the piano is not in any danger of losing its primacy just yet, you're raising the prospect of it in some decades.
Yeah, well, people are coming up with other keyboard designs and trying to keep them in such a way that they actually make sense for your hand. So like on the bottom row, you could play a scale and it would sound like a normal piano. But the next row above that might be slightly higher, and the next row above that slightly higher. And in fact, that keyboard design is sort of based on one that was done in 1555 by Niccolo Vicentino, who built a harpsichord with two manuals and split keys on each keyboard, and actually got 36 pitches to the octave. And there was some interest in it in the city of Ferrara in Italy for a couple of generations, then it died out.
Kyle Gann says a lot of people think microtonality means post-tonality, that there is a progression from tonality to atonality and then microtonality. He says microtonality is really a richer form of tonality in which the pitches are more in tune with each other. Hear more from Gann at WGLT.org. He is the author of The Arithmetic of Listening, Tuning Theory and History for the Impractical Musician. That's just out from the University of Illinois Press.
WGLT is a service of Illinois State University. Illinois State's 69.1% graduation rate is well above the national average. Illinois State's retention rate also remains among the highest in the nation at 78.6%. More at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the editor of a new book out from the U of I Press talks about the funding of public services and how cities and towns aren't as healthy as they might be assumed to be. That's coming up on 89.1 and WGLT.org. The Bloomington City Council has decided to take the next step toward possibly allowing cannabis sales once statewide legalization goes into effect January 1st. Council members voted Monday evening to send the cannabis discussion over to the Planning Commission to get more feedback at a public hearing next month. They could get into specifics about where exactly a cannabis dispensary could be located in Bloomington if someone wants to do that. Here in studio with WGLT's Ryan Denham to discuss where things stand is Ward 4 City Council member Julie Emick. She served on the city's cannabis task force.
And a lot of our work was gathering as much research and data as possible, but that process was never meant to circumvent a larger community process. So what I'm glad about in terms of what the Planning Commission can do for us is take it to that next level. There will be opportunity for more input from the community. People can weigh in on what this might look like should the city determine that we are not going to opt out. And it's time to hear a more diverse set of voices now.
Who still needs to chime in on this? It feels like we have been talking about cannabis a lot over the last year. What are those voices that you think are maybe still haven't been heard?
Well, I think that this will allow for residents to show up and say, hey, this is what I think. We have had public comment in the city council, but this is a specific meeting that is focused on the question of zoning, and it provides residents more opportunity to make comments. I also understand that Alderman Black has requested we get something in writing from community organizations that we can consider as we continue to deliberate over the next couple of months, November and December, and specifically to hear from the public schools, to hear from Wesleyan, to hear from community associations, perhaps neighborhood associations. I'm sure that that's just the beginning, but it might be helpful to have something that isn't just a conversation at the coffee shop or even a random conversation that one of the task force members had in the nature of our work, but something a little more formalized so that we can have a record of input.
So what did you think of sort of the draft version of an ordinance, of a zoning ordinance that City Attorney Jeff Juergens presented last night? This is the one that's based off of the Illinois Municipal League's kind of model ordinance.
Yes.
It states things like, cannabis businesses would require special use permits, they'd be prohibited from locating within 500 feet of schools, churches, playgrounds, can't be too close to residential areas, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think of that sort of draft, that model ordinance is a starting point?
I think it's a really good starting point. I think it provides a way to think about what this would actually look like. And I went to the IML conference in Chicago recently, and there were many sessions about this topic, as you can imagine. All of the sessions were standing room only. And a lot of what was suggested from a legal perspective, as well as just talking with other municipalities about how they were engaged in this conversation, was reflected in that draft plan that Jeff Juergens presented last night. I think that he is trying also to create the special use permit as to give us as much flexibility as possible locally, so that if someone is in violation of anything on that permit, we can take action. I know that the process for doing so is going to be different. Of course, this whole thing is different, but I maintain that it doesn't mean we should wait and see. I think we need to be more proactive, and as we're working towards a resolution that will work for this community, we are better positioned to make decisions by just trying something, you know. Let's make sure that we make it as safe and reasonable as possible. But I think the best way to figure that out is to do something engage in the process.
Let's take one step back. So you are one of two council members who served on this cannabis task force.
Yes.
That you mentioned. You did a lot of research, had a lot of meetings in a very short amount of time.
Yes.
Really a matter of weeks almost, or about a month. Do you think that group had enough time, had enough runway to work with? Would a few more weeks or another month been helpful?
It may have been helpful in that we could have garnered more of that formalized input that I referred to earlier. But on the other hand, when I think about the difference from the first meeting to the third meeting, and in the beginning, there was so much conversation from task force members about how they, while they came with expertise, you know, law enforcement or addiction specialist, business owner, they didn't necessarily know a lot about the legislation. And then in those 3 weeks, everyone kind of just dug in and really got as much information as possible so that in our second and third meetings, we could really have some substantive discussion about what it was we were finding and what we would recommend. For me, the task force was primarily about getting the ball rolling, getting more data, more information back to council, back to the community, and I think it succeeded in doing that.
And Councilmember Kim Bray said the recommendations which came out of the task force, at least opening the door for a cannabis dispensary in Bloomington, she called them predictable recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
because no school administrators or attorneys were named to the panel. What did you think of her criticism of the makeup of that body?
Yeah, I certainly didn't know where we would end up at the end of those 3 weeks, and I think that it wasn't unanimous. There was a lot of conversation about, for example, the impact on policing came up, and I don't know if predictable is the right way to frame it. I think it was rather just a deliberate process of reviewing as much information as we could and coming up with the best recommendation possible.
This work with the Cannabis Task Force, you're swimming in articles and research and data from states that have legalized and already kind of gone through this process. What are those things that should be instructive to the way that Bloomington thinks about this issue?
That's a really interesting question, because Illinois is the first state that has legalized cannabis from the legislature. So I know when Senator Steens talked about this legislation, one of the co-authors of the bill, she said that what they really tried to do was study what other states had done and learn from their mistakes. So when I read, for example, the Colorado Division of Criminal Justice report, which I think is one of the most even-handed reports I've read just in terms of presenting data, there are sort of indicators that if we, pursue having a business, what the state has done that's different is to highly regulate how these businesses are rolling out. So, for example, they're only allowing a certain number of licenses to be granted statewide, and that's a very careful calculation, and of course. The state is also targeting communities and residents who have been adversely affected by cannabis criminalization. So that is a key feature of this process. And I think that alone from the get-go is setting us out to be somewhat unique. The other thing is that there was a lot of concern in communities that if recreational cannabis were legal, that there would be a higher increase in youth. And the data from Colorado and Washington suggest that hasn't really borne out based on the analyses that they've done.
Youth using.
And they attribute that to sort of a less black market availability, but more importantly, perhaps overt discussion and education, because it's out there, and this is a mechanism for having conversations about kids making responsible choices and why that matters. And I think that the idea behind earmarking certain tax revenue for those kinds of social programs for education would be really something that Bloomington should consider if we decide as a council to allow cannabis business in our community.
So after all that, all the research that the task force has done, presuming that the zoning stuff can be sorted out, right, that it's going to go through the planning commission, it's going to come back to council, do you personally, Julie Emig, a council member from Ward 4, think the city should allow sales?
I do. I think the city should allow sales. The first reason why is because the state has made it legal. A lot of the concerns we have are going to be the result of the fact that recreational cannabis use is now legal for adults 21 and older. So it seems to me that it's our responsibility to create a safe and reasonable opportunity for people to engage in legal activity. I'm impressed with the incredible amount of care that the state has required anyone who's getting a license to dispense, to market, that they have to follow the security guidelines, the packaging guidelines, the advertising guidelines. I think that creates just a safer and more viable market for us.
What are your initial thoughts on, cannabis cafes, or basically a business where you would not only be able to sell cannabis, but people would be able to use on site, on the premises? Where's your head at there?
I would say the majority of the constituents in Ward 4 who've reached out to me, certainly not all of them, but the majority of them are in favor of having cannabis market in this community. However, the majority of them are not in favor of having cannabis cafes. And I think that in that case, perhaps we should slow down and just, see how we can progress. If we allow the sale of this legal product and not sort of go out of the gate with the cannabis cafes in conjunction with that, I think I think it's a big enough step and a big enough paradigm shift, to use one of the task force's terms, that offering that in addition would, at this point, would be harder for more people to get their heads around.
What are your thoughts on sort of the right tax rate for this? I think municipalities are able to tack on up to 3% on top to pull in revenue. Where do you think the city should be at with that? And if the city does go that route, where should that money go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another really interesting question. Senator Steens has this municipal toolkit for communities going through this, and she actually recommended that perhaps municipalities not jump right away to the highest tax rate, that it be more incremental, that, you know, what you don't want to do is create an opportunity for cannabis to be so expensive that there's, you know, this underground black market. And that has been a concern, a legitimate concern that we have to control for and watch for. Certainly the state has to be responsible for that. So I would urge, yes, we need revenue from this, because we need it to support the safety concerns and the social services and the public concerns that people have around education. But we also need to be careful about how much we tax and when.
If the city does pull in additional revenue off of cannabis sales, where that money should go? Should it be earmarked in a certain way? Just kind of go into the general pot? What are you thinking?
I think it should be earmarked. I think that it should, there should be, and we should be very transparent about that on council, that we will use the revenue generated, whether it's to for addiction services or educational programming in our schools, or if we decide that, you know, we need to get more of the police officers trained sort of in the how you detect on the road, for example, when you pull somebody over. There aren't any bona fide tests, although they're working on that, but there are ways of assessing. However, that work is going to happen regardless, because cannabis is becoming legal statewide. But there might be an opportunity to generate some of that revenue and funnel it for public safety.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Bloomington City Council member Julie Emig, who represents Ward 4. Her ward includes parts of downtown and all those areas immediately east of downtown, including several historic neighborhoods. So Julie, another action last night, the council approved hiring a Chicago-based consultant, the Lakota Group, for $50,000 to guide the development of a new community preservation plan. The city's last preservation plan was, I think, updated back in 2004, so it's been quite a while. So what is this all about? What is this plan going to entail?
I'm really excited about this plan because I know our historic preservation plan is very dusty, and while it will inform the creation of a new one, we really need a new one. And I was very impressed with the Lakota Group's proposal for a couple of reasons. First, they really have a strong mechanism for community input and outreach. They also are truly taking into account how to leverage historic preservation for an economic driver, and that's critically important. And in connection to our comprehensive plan, and finally, they not only plan but they strategize with the city and staff and community about how to implement. So those factors really I found to be persuasive. Most of it is going to be paid for via grant funding, and I know all grant funding is still taxpayer dollars, but it's earmarked for this, so why not bring it back into our community in the way that it's earmarked? And I think that certainly for residents in Ward 4, but truly for the whole city, this is going to be a really exciting process and will give us a way to move forward. And I think that a lot of folks are frustrated in our community that we do a lot of planning and not enough action. So I'd really like to see this plan do both.
What are those things in Ward 4 that are, you know, maybe unique, you know, those historic characteristics that would potentially benefit from having a better handle on our preservation planning?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I mean, everything from kind of what we can do with Franklin Park, you know, and create a better vision for that space, to finding ways for individual homeowners that you can get coded as a historical site, which allows you to have access to funds to improve your residence. And I think that that can also happen for businesses downtown and for businesses in the community that have this historical character. And we can find ways to, for example, what Leah Klein referred to last night when she talked about this, we can find ways to tie in the Route 66 work that we're doing. That's not just my ward, that's a lot of different parts of the community, but it's a very targeted way of thinking about how historic preservation can actually lift this community economically as well as just aesthetically.
That's Bloomington City Councilmember Julie Emig, who represents Ward 4. Julie, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking with you, Ryan.
I'm Ryan Depp.
According to a timeline provided by the Lakota Group, the preservation plan process will begin next month and include several forums for community input. The plan is scheduled to be done August 2020.
Support for WGLT comes from Westminster Village, a locally owned and operated not-for-profit providing quality retirement living, offering independent living, licensed assistant living, and skilled nursing care on a beautiful campus of more than 40 acres. Details at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Money's tight all over. A new book about government services makes that point acutely for cities and towns. The people's money, pensions, debt, and government services is just out from the University of Illinois Press. Kyle Gann is the editor of the book and the dean of the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He says cities and towns are not as healthy as people assume, even considering the exploding gross domestic product and the longest economic expansion in the history of the United States.
The cities are not reaping the full benefits of the growth in the national economy. And in fact, as one of the graphics points out, is that the general funds of municipalities, which is the major discretionary fund that cities meet their service responsibilities from, such as public safety, transportation, and the like, haven't rebounded to the levels that they enjoyed prior to the Great Recession. In other words, we're now at
13,
you know, almost 13 years beyond the Great Recession or the beginning of the Great Recession, and cities on average, now this isn't, you know, every city, some cities are doing much better, but some cities are doing much worse, that on average across the United States, municipalities have only this year, probably in 2019, have returned to the fiscal position that they were in 2006. Unlike the federal government, which returned to the pre-Great Recession level just a few years after the Great Recession. So I think part of what that tells us is that the economic growth of the United States in general is not reflected in the fiscal or the tax authority that municipalities have, and so they continue to search for all sorts of things to be much more efficient providers of services, but also to as we're seeing here in Chicago, that the challenge, and I think it's probably throughout Illinois, the challenge of bringing in enough tax revenues to meet your costs, your service delivery costs, have continued to challenge us.
In previous recessions, the book notes that recovery to pre-recession levels happened in the prior two recessions between 5 and 6 years afterwards.
Right.
Now, the Great Recession was great.
But
why, in addition to the depth of it, why has it taken so long for cities to recover?
Oh, I think the principal explanation is that the gross domestic product is a measure of consumption and investment and trade across the entire national landscape, and those numbers have increased rather in a rather healthy manner for over the 10 or 12 years now. But for governments that don't rely on sales but rely on a tax on sales, or rely on a tax on the value of property, or rely on a tax on income, the alignment of the tax structure and responsibility of cities doesn't nicely align with the underlying economic base of the nation, or in the case of municipalities, the underlying economic base of the city. So take principal reason that the federal government's finances rebounded in a matter of just a few years to what they were before the Great Recession is because the federal government relies heavily on the income tax. And the income tax is not just a tax on wages, which is, as we see, salaries and wages at lower incomes are just now beginning to improve a little bit, but wages at the upper income have increased fairly rapidly over the last 10 or 15 years. But not just the wage tax, but also the fact that the federal government taxes capital gains, and the stock market has just boomed. So anybody who is who owns shares of stock that are growing and growing at a very rapid rate are actually contributing to the Treasury of the United States. But there's only one municipality in the entire country that even taxes capital gains, and that's New York City. All the rest of the municipalities that do have what might be called an income tax is really just a wage tax. And so we know payroll and wages have not increased at quite the rapid rate as the growth in capital gains. So the federal government rebounds much quicker than cities or states. In Illinois, since no city has access to the income tax, cities in Illinois are highly dependent on the property tax and or the sales tax, and those have grown at a much more modest rate over time.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about the people's money, pensions, debt, and government services, a new book edited by Michael Pagano of the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs of the University of Illinois Chicago. And it's just out from the University of Illinois Press. So does this chain of reasoning also help explain why cities are lagging? That there has been growth in the number of jobs, but the jobs tend to be lower wage. Lower wage people don't have as much buying power because their buying power goes to providing basic necessities. So their contribution to the sales tax, which in Illinois is a big funder of municipalities as they have moved away from property taxes. So that is an additional reason for lower or flat growth.
You're absolutely correct. Retail sales growth has been fairly modest. I mean, it dropped pretty significantly in 2008 and 2009, and it picked up a bit. But taxable sales don't increase at the rate of spending because so much of what we do spend our dollar on is not taxable. So there's only so many shirts and shoes and televisions that people can buy, and then they max out and they stop buying them, or they don't replace them as often, and therefore this growth in the sales tax increases on those taxable goods rather modestly. Where there is more growth in spending on what we call consumer goods is really in the service sector, and the services for the most part are exempt from taxation in Illinois. So the sales tax itself is a what we call a narrow-based tax, meaning that when you apply whatever the tax rate might be, some places it's 6% and some places it's 10.5%. When you apply it on the base is a very narrow base. It's primarily tangible goods or goods that we can touch and consume, not so much on the service side, but where the growth in our spending has been on the service side, as we tend to become as we increase our family income, rather than buying more consumer taxable goods, we tend to buy more service goods, more healthcare services, more attorneys and accountants services, and other activities that are not part of the base. So, in the end, even if wages do increase a bit, and even if wages increase at the high end, the translation into the growth in retail sales taxes is rather modest.
Also complicating that is the changing sales patterns to the internet.
Exactly.
There has been some discussion by Illinois policymakers and elected leaders about broadening the tax base to include services. It's a tough political lift to get. How have other states that have broader sales tax bases fared in this ability for municipalities to pay for basic goods and services?
The breadth of the sales tax to cover services is actually a little better in our neighboring states than it is here. But again, it's not a broad-based service tax. So even though the municipalities in Iowa, for example, may be in a little better position because of the sales tax, a broader sales tax, or at the state level as well, it's not substantially larger. Where one would need to move to is somewhere like Hawaii that has a very broad service tax to note that municipalities could do better. Hawaii is a bad case because, or bad example, because it really doesn't have the kinds of it's much more of a unified state than it is a decentralized state, as Illinois and most other states are, in terms of the number of local governments they have. But if we could broaden our base and reduce the tax rate, I mean, imagine if we could take in Cook County the 10.25%, whatever it might be today, 10.25% sales tax and reduce it to say 5% or 4%, but broaden the base. And it could generate the exact same amount of money. The reason that becomes a heavy lift is because it affects very high paying activities, and people don't want to see that on their health service bill or on their accountant's bill or their lawyer's bill. But the other side of it is that that's the direction that we are spending our money. In fact, if you look over time, over the last 45 to 50 years, the percentage of our consumer dollar that goes to what are called taxable or tangible goods has declined from about 63% to 36%, and it's gone the other way for the services. So as we're increasing service consumption, we could actually increase our sales tax revenues if we had a base that included more of those services. But because our base is so restrictive here, we actually struggle to grow our tax receipts, our sales tax receipts, because the consumer is spending more for services than the consumer is on taxable goods.
How would a broader base affect the low to moderate income members of the public? Would they suffer a disproportional effect as they do on retail sales tax?
Actually, just the opposite, because not to say that there wouldn't be taxes at the low and moderate level, but because the rate would be lower, the shift would primarily be toward higher income individuals rather than lower income individuals. Right now, the retail sales tax, because of its very narrow base, it has a disproportionate impact on the lower and moderate income individuals than it does on higher income individuals. So it would have what's referred to as a progressive impact rather than a regressive impact that we currently experience.
The effect of the constriction of revenue for municipalities has been for them to cut some services, to consolidate others, to enter into agreements with other municipalities to spread the cost and to gain some efficiency. But they've also moved to user fees.
Yes.
What has been the consequence of that?
You've identified several issues there, so let's take sort of all of them. I think that it's critically important to understand that municipalities have quite successfully adapted to their changing financial world by creating many more economies of scale that, say, consolidation of services or interlocal agreements with other neighboring municipalities have generated. In other words, the cities are constantly looking for a more efficient way of delivering services, whether that's because that's what they should do because they're trying to maximize the taxpayer's dollar, or because they're forced to do so because the tax growth or the receipts have not increased at a very rapid rate, so they're wanting to maintain service delivery, and reduce the cost, same level of service delivery at a lower cost. Whichever of those explains their behavior, it's a good thing. Cities are more efficient in providing services today than, say, they were 20 years ago. To the second part of your question, and that is it falling disproportionately, if I understood your question, falling disproportionately on through the user fees on certain individuals, possibly. User fees are a way of it's a market-like mechanism that is a way of charging people for the consumption of an item. So let's take parking. Parking meters, if you are going to park in a particular place that has a parking meter, you benefit from parking your car there, and the rate that you're charged is the estimate of what the value is to you and to giving up that piece of land to the city. If I don't use that space, if I decide not to park my car and walk instead, then I'm not paying for that service. So user fees, behind the user fees, the principle is that people benefit when people pay for a service and they benefit from it directly, and others can't benefit from that service that you've just consumed, then charging a fee or a user fee for that privilege is appropriate, and it's a much more efficient allocation of resources. It also means that there isn't a cross subsidy of one individual for another. So, prior to the invention of parking meters in 1935, effectively everyone, because everything was dependent on the property tax, everyone was subsidizing the owner of a car who parked in front of the local hardware store.
Michael Pagano is the Dean of the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs, Director of the Government Research Center, and a Professor of Public Administration at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He is the editor of a new book, The People's Money, Pensions, Debt, and Government Services, just out from the University of Illinois Press. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.